unprogrammed science, right?
Thank you very much, Sevki. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm not sure exactly what time zone I'm in. I've been traveling around. It's always exciting for me to talk about this sort of new dimension. And I think, as Sevki mentioned, at least I've been discussing with Sevki since a road trip we did in India, must have been a little over a year ago. And we were thinking about programs, and we were thinking about the fact that science wasn't really engaged enough, and programs weren't engaged enough with science to look at this. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to give more examples of what I think is a scientific approach to programs, and maybe take a little bit of a view that not only do scientists need to be listening more to people in programs, but also people in programs need to think about what science is out there and how does that apply to what they're doing. So the current fashion in public health, and indeed in all of sort of clinical and medicine as well, is knowledge translation. You've probably heard this a lot in the last 2-3 years. Everybody's talking about knowledge translation. In my own sphere of activity, knowledge translation became very important in the last year. I had a job that was predominantly focused on knowledge translation in infectious diseases. But when I thought about it, I realized that knowledge translation in the context of public health and public health programs had the wrong paradigm. So if you think about science and knowledge synthesis and knowledge translation, it often addresses a single component in a single sphere of knowledge. In other words, what we do is we look at and we summarize the available scientific evidence about the protective efficacy of a vaccine or the effectiveness of a behavior change method. So we're focusing on a particular issue. And this can provide, I think, some evidence traps for public health, because once you find something that's efficacious from the scientific literature, a single intervention that proves to be efficacious, there's a strong drive by funders, by researchers, by policymakers to implement that intervention, that single intervention, because it's been proven to be efficacious or effective, or even cost-effective. So we look for these magic bullets. This is an effective vaccine, let's do that. This is an effective behavior change method, let's do that. But often, doing so ignores the specific epidemiological context. So it might have been effective under certain conditions in certain circumstances, but it may be inappropriate for a particular epidemiological context. But there's still this drive to implement it. And beyond the epidemiological context, it may ignore the social, cultural, political, and economic context. So it may be inappropriate in those ways as well. And of course, there's always unintended consequences of policies and interventions. There may be a change over time. So it might have been effective for a while, but it's no longer effective. And as Sevki mentioned, there could be a risk compensation within the population. So you might start with an intervention. It actually changes the environment on the ground. And you now are dealing with new issues, and it makes that intervention less effective. So there are some potential pitfalls to this idea of taking just the scientific literature, summarizing it, and pushing it into specific interventions. I think a very good case in point related to STD prevention is there's been now more than 30 randomized controlled trials with HIV incidence at the population or group level as an endpoint. These include behavioral interventions, technological interventions, biological interventions. Only 4 have had positive results, and 3 of those were on individual level randomized controlled trials on circumcision, and 1 was a randomized controlled community trial on enhanced STD control, which was then contradicted by 2 subsequent trials. So even though we have, I think, justifiably a lot of confidence in a lot of what we're doing in HIV prevention, the science isn't telling us that we're achieving anything. And I think that there's some possible explanations for this. It may be that the intervention really has no efficacy and we're deluding ourselves. We're deluding ourselves that condoms work, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we're not able to implement these interventions effectively in the context of a randomized trial. But that seems unlikely because you put the most money and the most effort and the most energy into randomized trials. A more plausible explanation to me is that these interventions were the wrong intervention or too little of an intervention for that epidemic at that time. And I think that that's the most likely explanation, is that we should take stock of the situation and understand that these single item interventions that are done on a population are not showing any efficacy, and that should tell us something a little bit about how we actually configure our interventions and think about science in that context. So just picking up on a theme that Sevgi mentioned, the idea of program science is not implementation science, because implementation science is primarily concerned with how to ensure the implementation of evidence-based interventions. In other words, we have an intervention that has evidence that supports it. Now, the science is about how do we get people to do that? How do we get physicians to prescribe the right medications? How do we get people to adopt the right behaviors? Program science was concerned with something at a higher and more strategic level, more of a meta level of analysis. The strategic focus and timing of interventions, with whom, when, for how long, optimizing this intervention mix, and also on optimizing program management and implementation processes that are necessary to get the desired coverage and quality. So it's not just about getting people to understand the literature and implement what they see in the literature. It's about something that's much more strategic and planning oriented than that. So if we look at it from a framework, implementation to program science, we need to think about the different spheres of knowledge that goes into a single program. So a single program like STD does not just think about the epidemiology and transmission dynamics. That's important for strategic planning and policy development, so that you can choose the right strategy for the right population at the right time. But you also need to know the interventions that are available for that population. Are they effective? And that helps you to decide whether you're doing the right things and doing them in the right way. But you also need to have ongoing information and knowledge about, based on surveillance operations research, that tells you about your program management to ensure that you can have the appropriate scale, efficiency, and are able to change your program when needed. So when you think about the knowledge that's required for a single program, it cuts across a variety of knowledge domains, and so you have to draw on science in a number of knowledge domains just to implement one program effectively in public health. I'm going to give two illustrative examples, and here what I want to do is convey the importance of taking information and knowledge and thinking about it strategically when we convert it into programs, and not getting caught in traps of sort of taking the implementation science route. I'm going to start with an example from my home province in Manitoba, our chlamydia control strategy. This is a little bit old because I haven't worked there for a number of years. And then I'll talk a little bit about strategic considerations in HIV prevention programs for female sex workers. And I'm just going to give some examples here. So the first was the Manitoba Chlamydia Control Program in the 1990s. Some of you may be familiar with this story. So, and I call this story, "Let That Make Sense, Let's Do a Lot of That." So we have the tried and true STI control method of case detection through testing and contact tracing. It's very difficult to argue with this logic. You find somebody who's infected, you find out their contacts, you treat them, and you sort of try to interrupt the transmission. And then bingo, in the 1990s, we came up with a diagnostic test for chlamydia. So we were able to now add testing and contact tracing in a real way to chlamydia, the pathogen chlamydia trachomatis. And so the impetus, not just in Manitoba, I'm sure everywhere else, was to scale up screening and contact tracing for chlamydia. This was the let's do a lot of that notion. And so starting in the late 1980s and early 1990s, we did a lot of that. We did a lot of, there was enormous enthusiasm for our results. You can see that the rate of chlamydia in both females and males declined. Little bit of a problem there sort of at the end, and the epilogue, which I'll tell you now, is that the rates then started to go back up again. And I'll try to explain perhaps why. This is just an analysis The rates of incident, the incidence rates of reported chlamydia cases by postal area in our province. And what I want to point, and the yellow bars represent the rates as they were in 1991, which was close to the beginning of this scaling up of contact tracing and testing for chlamydia. And the red line shows the rates 7 years later in 1998. And the point I want to make here is that this strategy actually had a disproportionate benefit in the areas where the rates were already the lowest. So that's perhaps not surprising. The people who were accessing the testing and the people where the public health nurses were able to do effective contact tracing tended to live in the areas where the rates were the lowest, the suburbs and the more affluent areas. If you analyze these postal areas by income, the areas where the highest rates were the areas where the income levels were the lowest. And so we had implemented a strategy without thinking about geographic targeting of that strategy. And it was effective at reducing the overall rate, but it wasn't reducing the rate in the highest risk areas. And in fact, it was increasing the disparities in rates between geographic areas. And we've had an enormous bounce back in chlamydia rates in Manitoba in the last 10 years, and a lot of that has been in those areas where we weren't effective in our program of reducing the rates during the 1990s. So our emphasis on diagnosis, case finding, and treatment, it appears to have been more effective in lower risk areas. The residual rates in several of the core areas might be less important or insufficient really in controlling the overall epidemic. And we need to think about how would the program and results have changed if we had targeted our program more strategically to reduce the chlamydia incidence rates in the areas with the highest incidence. But that wasn't really what we were thinking about at the time. We were thinking about implementing a new technology. So let me move to my second and last example, and that is the strategic issues in female sex worker-focused prevention programs. And this is based on observations that there's a high variability in HIV and STI prevalence in sex workers. And this is, I'm now reflecting on some experience overseas in India, some work we've been doing in India. And what's striking about this is that you can't really correlate the HIV and STI prevalence with the average behaviors or characteristics of the sex workers. So you can have a range of prevalence between 5% and 35%, and the behaviors of the sex workers in the two environments don't look any different in terms of number of clients, condom use rates. But what we do see is that the configuration of sex work and female sex worker networks really do differ in different locations. So the behaviors of the individuals don't differ, but how sex work is organized differs. And so it struck us that programs could gain efficiency and higher impact if we were a little bit more strategic in thinking about what the configuration of the sex work networks were in different locations. This was sort of a very instructive analysis that was done by Azragani and Dr. Arau on it was a modeling study to try to look at scenarios of different kinds of patterns of interaction between clients and sex workers. And this was to sort of examine the potential importance of the client-sex worker mixing patterns and what that would do to the epidemiology of STIs. And this was very important for us in our programs because it started to show us that holding everything else constant, the number of clients and the number of sex workers constant, just the way in which they mixed with each other made a big difference in terms of the epidemiology of STIs. So there's two properties they looked at. They looked at the clustering. If you go from the left-hand side, let me try to do this on here. So if you go from scenario 1 to scenario 2, or scenario 3 to scenario 4, what you see is what's happening is you're going from symmetry in the number of clients per sex worker, so every sex worker has the same number of clients, to a clustering of clients with certain sex workers. So now some sex workers have more clients than others. Total number of clients doesn't change, total number of sex workers doesn't change, but now some sex workers have lots of clients and some sex workers have few clients. And so you're now starting to cluster sex workers or clients with sex workers. The second dimension they looked at was going from scenario 1 to 3 or 2 to 4, so going down on this diagram, you're going from a situation where clients stay with the same sex worker to a situation where clients start visiting different sex workers. So you're changing, you're now starting to randomly distribute the clients among sex workers. And so these are two important system properties that probably have real importance for epidemiology. And this was the results. When they looked at HSV2 as an example of a long duration virulent STD, you can see that different scenarios result in different epidemiology, and these are the prevalence of these of in different populations, sex workers, clients, and the general population. You can see that even though the number of clients and sex workers is the same, the way in which they interact with each other and form partnerships really changes the epidemiology. And so we need to think about what will that mean for our programming and how we target our programs. So the important properties that are here is the clustering of the networks and the clustering of clients among different sex workers. And I'll just show you a couple of examples. Here's some actual data from a program we're running in a district called Bagalkot in South India. And I just want to point out two sub-district regions within that district where we've done a lot of work. Taluka A and Taluka B. Taluka is the name of a sub-district unit. So here you have the same number of sex workers per 1,000 adult men, but what you have is you have much bigger clusters of sex workers in this taluka than you have in this taluka. And you have a lot of villages with a lot of sex workers in this taluka and not in this. So you have, in taluka A, you have a lot of clustering, these large clusters of sex workers where you can have more client turnover. And if you look at the adult prevalence in taluka A, it's threefold higher than it is in taluka C. Even though male behaviors are the same, the number of sex workers is the same per capita, the number of clients per sex worker on average is the same in those two talukas, but the prevalence is much different in the general population. So obviously the importance of targeting these high volume clusters of sex workers in taluka A will have a disproportionate impact on the epidemiology than doing a more general program in taluka C. And just to show an example of clustering of clients, what, you know, does this actually happen in real life? This is client clustering showing the distribution of client volume among female sex workers in 8 cities of Pakistan. This is a project that we did with the national program there. And I just want to point out that if you look at cities ranging from Faisalabad here to Hyderabad here, you see two ways that we've measured the clustering of clients, one with the Gini coefficient, and the second, which is maybe more accessible, percentage of clients among the top 20% sex workers. So we rank the sex workers based on the number of clients. And you can see that the top 20% of sex workers had 56% of the clients here, but 32% in Faisalabad. So you had much, much more clustering of clients amongst a smaller group of sex workers in Hyderabad than you did in Faisalabad. So obviously our program has to be different in Hyderabad than in Faisalabad. We can target high-volume sex workers in Hyderabad. We can't target high-volume sex workers in Faisalabad because almost every sex worker has the same number of clients. So it's taking some of these theoretical findings and looking at them in terms of program implications. So program implications here, focusing on locations with large sex worker clusters is not only efficient, it will likely have a disproportionate impact on HIV transmission dynamics. And if there is asymmetric distribution, increase the efficiency of program interventions by focusing on the high client volume sex workers, as we could do in the Pakistan example. So just to summarize, program science is about knowledge-based planning and implementation. Knowledge comes from different spheres, and it needs to be integrated in the various processes of program planning and implementation. And aligning our knowledge acquisition with program needs is only half the battle. We also need to have programs that are prepared and thinking about how they can integrate knowledge into their work. So thank you very much. And should I tee this up? Mm-hmm.